we're building soil hills through the cows, so the cows are essentially working for us, adding the biology to the soil as we feed what we grow on that soil. So the only thing at the end of the day we're really taking off the soil is a pound of beef versus a bunch of hay or corn and taking all the organic matter from it. We're basically using the sun and rain. I personally don't buy much fertilizer. If I can fix something with a bale of hay, a cow, or a bag of seed, I'd rather do that than fertilizer and hauling a bunch of costly inputs in. Actually, at the end of the year, we do taxes now. It's not so quite as easy to show a loss as it used to be. So we're coming onto a new problem there, but we'll be able to handle that one. Yeah. So.
Welcome to the 350th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. Langdon Colum farms in a part of west central Minnesota where the soil starts to thin out to the point where it's not unheard of to hit gravel when digging down just a bit past the surface. But that hasn't prevented farmers from planting corn and soybeans in the region. And Langdon, who owns and operates Colum Family Cattle near the community of Eagle Bend, does raise row crops himself. But the former dairy farmer would prefer to produce beef cattle on forages, which he has done for the past several years. Langdon has long rotationally grazed his Black Angus cow-calf herd, but a few years ago he learned that adjusting the manner in which those animals are rotated can pay big dividends in terms of building soil health, which in turn pays off by creating a more productive herd. Working with Jonathan Kilpatrick and Kent Solberg, grazing and soil health experts with the Sustainable Farming Association, Langdon increased his stocking density and adjusted the sizes of his paddocks, which are growing permanent pasture as well as annual cover crops. It turns out such tweaks to a rotation can, in a sense, increase the size of a farm without actually adding additional acres. It's like adding vertical productivity via the soil biome. It's paid off. Not only is his herd more productive in the short term, but Langdon feels his soil's long-term resiliency has improved as well. That was proven the past two growing seasons, which saw his region go from extreme drought to flood conditions that were so bad his cattle found themselves stranded on opposite sides of running water at one point. I saw the results of this soil building firsthand during a mid-September field day held at the Colum Farm. The event was sponsored by Match Made in Heaven, Livestock Plus Crops, which is an initiative that's helping show ways crops and livestock can be integrated in a profitable and sustainable manner. Match Made in Heaven is a six-state collaboration involving 50-plus groups, including the Land Stewardship Project. Also participating in the field day were the SFA's Jonathan Kilpatrick and Jane Jewett of the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture. During the field day, Jonathan and Langdon dug up soil samples to show how worn-out crop fields have been revitalized after just a few years of exposure to a grazing regime that involves a diversity of plants and careful movement of cattle that spreads manure and urine evenly across the landscape, helping build biology. Particularly impressive was a field that had formerly grown a stand of fertility-sapping hybrid poplar trees, but which Langdon is bringing back to life utilizing cover cropping and animal impact. After the field day, Langdon, Jonathan, and I sat down in a back room of the nearby Rose City Bar and Grill to talk about how integrating livestock into crop ground can help revitalize the soil, as well as a farm's bank account. Langdon started our conversation talking about how adjusting the carrying capacity in his paddocks helped up the farm's rotational grazing game.
Okay, I bought the original farm in 2007, 150 acres, and started out with, I believe I bought 7 cows the first year, and from there I bought all the way up to around 15, and then from that I've built a herd as, I believe at the highest point we've had 65 pairs. Over the years I've added a 40 acres and then at least a couple other farms at 100, 120 acres apiece. Basically concentration has always been on raising beef cattle and having the healthiest pastures we can. I grew up conventional dairy farming with my father. I guess my heart was always into beef cows and we parted ways, so from there we've just done it my own way, always rotated some, and I believe for going on 10 years now we've started to focus on more rotational grazing and getting more out of each acre rather than just more land all the time.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned was you had a couple years ago, I think maybe, I don't know, 3 or so years ago, you really kind of upped your game a little bit with the rotations where you started doing some different things, I think doing more movements, that type of thing.
I'd always rotated to some degree. My 150 acres used to be split up in roughly 3 different pastures. And then from there, about 6 years ago, we split it up into 15 different sections and had rotations on 2 to 3 days in each section. And I ran into a fellow from Sustainable Farming named Kent Solberg, and he and Jonathan quizzed me on stocking density, and that didn't make a lot of sense to me because my pastures were always the same size and I wasn't going to buy and sell cows to change stocking densities. Well, then they introduced me to the polywire and varying the size of the paddocks with the same number of cows, and really in the last 2 years I've seen tremendous difference in the varying stocking densities depending on your situation and your goals, and I've actually been able to achieve, and I can see the potential to really double the carrying capacity versus where I was 3 or 4 years ago just doing a more standard rotation system.
I think that's a really good point, and Jonathan, that's one thing. You had a really nice presentation on that idea of doubling, of what carrying capacity is, which I think would maybe be a good reminder for folks what is carrying capacity, but also if you could talk a little bit about when you are doubling that carrying capacity, it's like you're doubling the size of your farm in a way. Can you talk a little bit about that? I think that's a really important piece people don't think about because land is expensive, and it's much easier to add value to that land than to try to get more land.
It's a really good point to the carrying capacity. It's just, I guess the way I define it is, it's what your land can carry as far as livestock. And obviously that changes every single year. But in the example I like to use is, for example, like an F-150 or a half-ton truck, it only has so much capacity as far as what it can tow and what it can pull. You go up to an F-350 or a one-ton truck, and you can really do a lot more hauling and, you know, a lot more towing. So the carrying capacity of those trucks is very different. That's kind of the same way with rotational grazing. And most people, when they go to what Langdon just talked about, is when they start rotationally grazing or doing more frequent moves, like get up to once a day moves, most people are able to double the carrying capacity. And the reason for that is because grass that's not being overgrazed, if the cattle are going back and nipping off little shoots and stuff, that's slowing the grass growth and the recovery back, slowing that down. So you're not getting as much forage growth and production. So really in the long run, what you're achieving is more forage production per acre, which allows you to carry more cows or have more cows per acre.
Yeah, and it's that whole idea of kind of using soil health to add value to that land. I hope this isn't offending you, Langdon. This isn't the best soil in the world. I think that's something you know. It's sandy, and you said in one of the fields we looked at this evening, you don't go too far down, you hit gravel. So you are able to add value to that land by building soil health, it sounds like.
Correct. I'm building soil health through the cows, so the cows are essentially working for us, adding the biology to the soil as we feed what we grow on that soil. So the only thing at the end of the day we're really taking off the soil is a pound of beef versus a bunch of hay or corn and taking all the organic matter from it. We're basically using the sun and rain, and I personally don't buy much fertilizer. If I can fix something with a bale of hay, a cow, or a bag of seed, I'd rather do that than fertilizer and hauling a bunch of costly inputs in.
Jonathan, one of the things, we were standing next to a stand of, correct me if I'm wrong, it was a stand of Japanese millet. It was a 7-way mix, but the Japanese millet was dominating because it's a wet year and they like wet weather. But you kind of said, here's a quiz, what are the principles of soil health? And I think it'd be good if you go through those principles, but then also you said, we're kind of seeing, this is the living proof right here, we're seeing all of those principles of soil health being covered right now. Can you describe why we were seeing those? First describe what they are, but then describe why we were seeing all those covered on Langdon's land there.
Yeah, so the six soil health principles are minimize disturbance, and that's both chemical and physical disturbance of the soil with a plow. It would be diversity, so increase the diversity of species of plants on the soil, and that also increases the diversity of, you know, wildlife and insects and birds and all that. The other thing is armor on the soil, very important to keep the soil covered. Integrating of livestock, the integration of livestock is also another key, and the living root. Living root is also key, keeping the living root in the soil as long as possible. And then doing all these things in the context of your operation, which for every operation is very different. Langdon's context is different than some of the other farmers that I work with. And yeah, so when we were standing there where the millet there, I mean, we had good soil cover. We were getting a lot of armor put back down in the soil. I mean, Langdon was grazing cattle at about 1 million to 1.5 million pounds per acre. So the amount of trample that we were getting, we weren't getting super high utilization rates on the millet, but that's okay because we're recovering the soil, we're increasing soil health. Cows were getting the best, really, of that millet anyhow. We had, you know, diversity of species on the soil surface. We had living root. We had plants actively growing. We had livestock on the soil. We were doing it within the context, and we weren't disturbing the soil. I mean, we weren't plowing. We weren't using chemical or anything. So all six soil health principles were in action in front of us. So, yeah, really cool to see that. And that's typically what you'll see, you know, in most grazing operations. And it's kind of an interesting joke that some of us SFA staff have is that, you know, most people that go down this regenerative journey, so to speak, they end up becoming grazers because of the soil health principles all being in action when you're grazing. And if you look back through civilization, like when you start annual cropping, that's really where the downfall of that civilization begins, is when they start destroying the soils through annual cropping. I mean, we see that the downfall of Rome and a lot of these other great empires throughout the history. So yeah, I mean, you look at what these soils would have been 200 years ago, they would have been native prairies. So we're the closest. I mean, we can't replicate that perfectly, but we are coming as close as we possibly can with what the tools we have available to us.
Mm-hmm. And as proof positive of that, after we looked at the summer annuals that you're grazing there, we went over to a permanent pasture that you've established, Langdon, and you, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was in row crops for several years, and you, I don't know, how many years ago was it? About 6 years ago, you seeded that down to pasture. Jonathan dug up some soil samples, and it looked really good. And, yeah, so you haven't had a decent rain since the first week in August. Boy, that pasture looked great. It was really flourishing, green, and the soil, I just felt like it had some latent moisture in it. It really was working well. Can you talk a little bit about how long that took to kind of get to that point after it being in row crops for all those years, and kind of what you're seeing with the soil a little bit?
When I took over the field, it had been corn and bean rotation for years, basically rented to the neighbor, and I continued renting to the neighbor shortly after I had bought the place for a source of income and basically just good relations. But when I started getting more cows, I decided I wanted to turn that field into a pasture, so I went to the NRCS office and they suggested a mix, which turned out to be, I didn't know what I was buying, but I bought it, seeded it, and first year just made hay and let the roots get rooted down and established, and from there started grazing it and haying it once in a while. But then I would say about 3 years ago, when I got into the more intensively rotating the cows, I noticed the pasture would be, you know, ready to graze again much quicker than ever. When the dry times came, the grass still seems to grow, and I did not know why. We've been through 3 years of drought, and that pasture that was seeded down and grazed conservatively and always left enough for regrowth, pasture seems to hold out throughout the year no matter what. And now when you dig down in the soil, you do see a lot of earthworms. It smells good, and just, you know, standing in the pasture, it's hard to find a patch of dirt anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's, this year has been quite the opposite. We've had several rains, 3+ inches. And though it's been muddy and the cows have pugged it up quite a bit, the pasture just continuously regenerates itself.
Yeah, you said it had 40 days of rest, and it looked great, really did. Jonathan, we've had 3 years in most areas of really dry weather. Now we've had the faucet, we can't turn it off. You must get around and see folks who are using good grazing systems and regenerative grazing systems to build their soil health, and you're seeing now the two extremes of the weather cycle. Are they able to build that soil to the point where it is able to be resilient when it's in drought conditions and when we're having this you know, really, I think we're on track to maybe be one of the wettest years that we've ever had in your recorded history here in Minnesota. Are you seeing where they are able to build that soil resilience so it is able to weather those, pardon the pun, weather those real extremes?
Yeah, I would say in general, like, you know, the soil health is a journey. And so I don't even know, I don't think anybody really has an idea of what the top is, or if there even is like a top as far as soil health goes. You know, we're dealing with massively degraded systems. I will say that, you know, instituting a lot of these practices and the principles of soil health does definitely increase resilience, but we don't really know at what point in the journey these folks are on, whether they're in, you know, their beginning stages. But yeah, to answer your question, I'm kind of long way around to get to the answer, but yeah, I would say in general, for sure. But also, you know, it involves like good management decisions when you do have a drought, like destocking at the right time or getting cows off and increasing that recovery period. But, you know, I would say you can have really good soil, and when you have a wet season, you're just having a wet season too. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I don't want to like pretend like it's just a magic fairy dust. It does help, absolutely, 100%. So the farms that are doing this and turning into, you know, going to perennial pastures or whatever, just doing soil health practice are definitely able to weather these extremes that we've had in the last couple of years.
Langdon, you joked a little bit that you bought drought insurance this year, and the salesman's probably off in Tahiti. So you never know. But, you know, I feel like some of your insurance is really building that soil health in the long term a little bit. I don't know if that's the way you look at it.
Correct. I figured 3 years in a row of drought, if I had a force when I needed a little money to buy hay, so I went ahead and bought drought insurance, but it seemed like the rain turned on, and it was a whole different challenge. There wasn't a place I could put the cows without mud. In fact, at one point, my entire farm was separated by the creek running through, and some calves were on one side of the creek, and the other cows, their mamas on the other side, 6 feet deep.
Yeah.
So there's been some challenging days this year, but too much water has definitely been a problem, but I have yet to complain about it because I will always take more water than less. I will say that I am glad that I've been on this journey with building the pastures up, because I feel like my pastures have actually weathered the storm much better than they would have 10 years ago.
I'm really interested in anybody who's kind of transitioning row crops into pasture and grazing, that type of thing. But you took us to something I've never seen before. It was a former poplar plantation, I guess. Can you describe the history of that piece of ground? I think it was in, the trees were actually cut 5 years ago, and you had to do some pretty extreme stuff to that. But you're trying to kind of, it's an interesting, it's on a different scale, trying to you know, it's one thing to transition a corn soybean field into grazing, but this is a whole different ball game with this poplar stand that was across the road from your farm there.
In this area, I would say about 30 years ago, there was an outfit that bought several thousand acres, something to the tune of 10 or 12,000 acres, and put into hybrid poplar trees for paper production. But their plan did not work out, and a lot of this land, farmers are removing the trees and going back into farming. The particular piece that used to be part of my farm, I purchased it back with the trees standing on it, and didn't really know what I was going to do with it, but the journey started. We had the trees cut off and all the brush and stumps were left. So for a few years, I tried to use the cows. They could get around the field, step over the tree limbs and whatnot. You could not drive a four-wheeler across the 40 acres.
Yeah.
So for a few years, I just grazed it whenever there was standing water in the field the cows could drink, and then would pull them off until there was another opportunity to graze something. The land was pretty poor, as you can imagine. The tree roots had dug pretty deep and pulled most of the nutrients out and left it in a state of some pretty rough grass and obviously the tree limbs everywhere. But a few years of grazing, and then I basically bought a cheap tractor and a disc and beat it across the top of the stumps and seeded down about a, I think it was a 15-way mix. And what took off happened to be the buckwheat, sorghum sedan grass, and some soybean and stuff like that. And that began the process, gave the cows a lot of biomass to eat and start the process of rotting down the stumps and tree limbs. And so after really only 3 years, it's become a field that I could conceivably plant corn in next year. And thanks to the cows doing most of the work, though I did pick a lot of sticks up.
You did a little bit of the work. But, and let's be clear, you're thinking about planting corn, but you're not, you're going to graze it, right?
Correct. I'll use that corn as a basically a deep of the winter feed. Typically around here, it's not uncommon to have 1 or 2 feet of snow on the ground, so the corn cobs will be above the ground, and basically I'll give the cows a few rows of corn a day throughout the winter time, and supplement with a bale of hay here and there, and that way everything that field grows is pretty much returned to the dirt, and really no loss of income because we're harvesting it with the animals.
You're keeping your options open as far as raising row crops like corn and beans, but it sounds like you're not, you would just as soon not go back to that, if I understand correctly. You're really kind of sold on letting the cows harvest that. Is that kind of what you're looking at now, that it's, as you have a little bit more success with this?
Basically, my heart's really not in sitting in a tractor and row cropping. I do believe, though, that the most resilient farm is going to be the one with the most diverse sources of income. So to put all my efforts into cows only, the cow market could crash or something eventually and leave me sitting and perhaps on too much beef and when I could be selling corn or something. So I'm leaving my options open, leaving some ground tillable, though my preference is to graze perennials. However, I'd also thought quite a bit about maybe establishing a relationship with a row crop farmer in the area where we traded fields around and grazed for a few years and then row cropped a few years, or even the same year, just row crop and put the cows on the following cover crop.
So the theme of the field day is transitioning, or is integrating livestock back into the farm. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on if somebody is thinking about transitioning livestock back into a farm, integrating livestock back into something that's been in row crops for years. Is there a couple, three things people should be thinking about, first steps that they should be doing? It sounds like Langdon's kind of eased into this, and then he kind of upped his game a few years ago and has really seen some results. But, you know, you don't want to have throw all your eggs in one basket and then have a disaster. So is there some things that people should be looking at?
Yeah, I would say the land needs the livestock, but that doesn't mean that each farmer has to do the livestock themselves. There's lots of examples of successful partnerships where the crop or the row crop farmer has a livestock farmer come in and do the livestock part of it. They don't have to own the livestock. You can successfully partner. There are, you know, sites like the Midwest Grazing Exchange or the Minnesota Cropland Grazing Exchange where crop farmers can put out land and say, I have corn stocks for grazing, or I'm going to plant some cover crops. Can I get someone in coming in? So I would say that's one of the things is, like, if you are a row crop farmer, don't feel like you have to take on that extra responsibility of the livestock. But if you do decide to do that, I mean, that's great. And I think it's, you know, take some baby steps, find some mentors, people who have done it, who can help you out. You can, you know, reach out to Land Stewardship Project or Sustainable Farming Association. You know, we've got folks that have a lot of experience with livestock integration. So yeah, I think it's take some baby steps. And honestly, like, I think the biggest thing is going to be water, getting water to livestock. A lot of people overthink the water thing. You know, I actually just picked up for my own farm a water hauling rig for a couple $100. It's an old running gear, and I've got capacity for 400 gallons on this trailer, and I could add another couple hundred gallon tank. And so for a couple $100, I've got a way to haul water. And typically when you're doing a lot of this cropland grazing, it's going to be in the fall and winter when water requirements are already low. So a good fence around your field and some water, and you'll be off to the races. So, but yeah, take it slow, take the baby steps. But the most important thing is the land does need the livestock. It's super important for nutrient cycling and to, you know, follow the soil health principles. So
I guess I've always kind of gone under the a train of thought that never stick your neck out any further than you can afford to get it chopped off. So I've kind of started, you know, if I invest something in this journey, I don't always expect a return on it. But by and large, I would say 8 out of 10 times I try something new, it turns out to be positive. And the 2-3 times it doesn't turn out positive, I can usually see why. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's my own stubborn way of thinking, and sometimes it was just a bad weather pattern or something. But to date, I don't regret anything I've tried. It all seems to be working positively. And actually, at the end of the year, we do taxes now. It's not so quite as easy to show a loss as it used to be. So we're coming onto a new problem there, but we'll be able to handle that one.
Yeah. So I love that regenerative agriculture and following soil health is starting to create tax problems for him. So I think that's a really good testimonial. Like, let's create massive tax problems for farmers by following soil health. Like, let's that's awesome. So
I don't know if that'll fit on a bumper sticker, but, you know, we could try.
You can figure it out.
For more on building soil health profitably, integrating livestock and crops, and the Match Made in Heaven initiative, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 350 at landstewardshipproject.org. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, a Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.